Welcome to Witch Lit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witch Lit is brought to you by Thousand Volt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. All our titles can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. If you'd like to support Witch Lit, please consider buying us a coffee at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast. Alice Markham Cantor is a writer and fact checker from Brooklyn, New York. She's the author of The Once and Future Witch Hunt, A Descendant's Reckoning from Salem to the Present, and her reported work has been published in New York Magazine, Scientific American, The Nation, and elsewhere. She serves on the working committee of the International Network Against Witch Hunting. Alice Markham Cantor, welcome to Witch Lit.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, I'm excited to have you on. I thoroughly enjoyed the book, and we will get into all of the reasons for that. But our first question for everybody on the show, just especially in this time of hot takes and social media and all that, why still write? Why still write books?
You went for the big one first.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. For sure. Why still write books? I mean, I think that I have two answers to this. The first one is sort of my personal answer, which is that I don't know how to stop. I sort of can't not do it. My entire life I have been keeping a notebook and writing, keeping documents on my computer and producing scenes and fiction and nonfiction, and just sort of I understand the world through the prism of language, and that is sort of the only way that it makes sense to me. And when I, if I stop writing for a few days too long, people around me start to notice. They're you're getting kind of weird. Can you please go open your notebook or something? Cause it's just sort of it. It's what clarifies me, and what lets it work. So why write books for me personally is that first I have to. Mm-hmm. And why write books in this moment? I think that the written word is not to overly fetishize it, but it is one of the most powerful methods of human communication that we have. It is something that collapses time and space, right? When you read a book written by somebody else in another time, in another location, and you realize that they are experiencing something that you have experienced, or experienced something totally foreign to you, but that you nonetheless recognize in some way, that is a kind of power in reflecting humanity to itself that I think is close to unparalleled. Mm-hmm. And I think that we could use some of that empathy right now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I think about that a lot, about especially reading fiction develops your empathy. I think mm-hmm. it's just, I have people in my life who are just hardcore nonfiction readers, and they'll mm-hmm. occasionally read a novel, but I'm always surprised, because if someone tells me all they read are hardcore nonfiction, not about people, I'm just it's so foreign to me. It's just so foreign to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, for me personally, and I think for much of humanity, story is the thing that actually sticks. Mm-hmm. You may be communicating the same ideas, the same information as a nonfiction book, but when it is told through a story, we're hardwired to take those in and retain them in a different way. And so I think that the power of sort of engaging with that is real.
Yeah, no, I agree. So it was interesting how you were talking about that you write fiction and nonfiction, because this book really is kind of a blend of things.
Yeah, it's a hybrid.
And I really wanted to ask you about that, because the way you tell the narrative of what happened in Salem, especially, centered on Martha Carrier, and then the way you tell your own story of kind of reckoning with Salem and all that continues to come after. Do you just want to talk about how that came together for the book?
Yeah. So So it has these two narrative threads that I can just describe for those who haven't read the book yet, which is that one narrative thread, and it alternates every other chapter. One narrative thread is basically written as historical fiction. It's as true as I could make it based on trial records and primary source documents, but it is written as narrative fiction about my ancestor, Martha Carrier, and what happened to her before she was hanged in Salem, and what happened in Salem overall. And then the other narrative thread is nonfiction completely from my point of view, as I was trying to put Martha's life back together and beginning to then research witch hunts happening around the world today. And that the past present connection is a big part of why I did it this way. You know, there are a lot of books out there on Salem. There are a lot of excellent books out there on Salem, but most of them, they tend to fall into two categories, you know, like nonfiction or sort of fictionalized accounts of Salem that may or may not lean into there actually being magic, which is a separate thing that we can discuss as well. Mm-hmm. But almost none of them deal with the fact that witch hunts still happen around the world on a, you know, more than weekly basis. Somebody is accused of witchcraft and by somebody else's community, and then this be followed by you know, torture, exile, being killed. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, up to maybe our numbers are bad, but up to 2,000 of these happen a year worldwide, it's possible. So it was really important to me to sort of put Salem, to not treat Salem as exceptional and as this thing that is sort of the quintessential witch hunt that is over, mm-hmm. but rather to place it on a long string of witch hunts and sort of reflect its place in history.
Yeah. Well, I think it was so interesting to me that there's kind of a secondary character that comes up in your narrative regarding your interaction with Caliban and the Witch, the author. Oh, like, the name just fell out of my head.
Sylvia Federici.
Yes, thank you. With Sylvia Federici, that you just happened to kind of live in the same neighborhood when you're writing this book. So do you want to talk about that a little bit and how that shifted?
There were a couple of coincidences while I was writing this book where I was like, nobody's going to believe this when I say that this is the nonfiction part. A few months into sort of after I finished my thesis, which was where the book, when I started the research, I went to an author talk in my neighborhood that Sylvia Federici was doing. And it turned out that not only did she live in my neighborhood, but she is incredibly welcoming to, you know, young, like writers and organizers and feminists. And she was like, yes, come over and we'll talk more about this. And, you know, sent me, like gave me a bunch of like clippings that she had on the topic and sort of jump-started some of my research there. Mm-hmm. And it was incredible. And I've been working with her for the past few years.
Again, for folks who haven't read the book, there's an afterword that mm-hmm. Federici's written for the book that I think contextualizes a lot of that latter half stuff that I thought was really remarkable. But, I think one of the things that was interesting, or just one of the things that initially drew me to the book, is that mm-hmm. you are an ancestor of the witch trials, specifically Martha Carrier, who's the main focus in the narrative part of the book. But do you want to talk about like what that relationship has been like? I mean, you talk about it in the book, and I don't want to, you know, like spoil too much, I guess, but just kind of like what that has meant for you, I guess, writing the book and after.
I mean, so Martha Carrier is my direct ancestor. I'm 11 generations from her, so she's my 9 times great grandmother. And she is what drew me to the story in the first place, right? Like, she was my entry point. She was the thing that I was chasing, because my sort of organizing question at the beginning, what was propelling me along this path, was that I wanted to know why she had died and who she had been when she was alive. And chasing one person through an event like the Salem witch trials is, I mean, in some ways, I think it's a great way to do it. where it sort of, it really focuses the research and the way that you're looking at the story. And it also made me feel a little bit crazy at times, because like I am learning everything that I can about this woman. I am sort of trying to puzzle piece her life back together. And for some things, I have no idea if I'm right, because a lot of the information has been lost, and some of the information about her never existed in the first place. For example, I have no idea what she looked like. Like, that's just a basic, very simple thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you're envisioning a character, when you're writing them, to have actually no idea what this person looks like is a weird place to start. Yeah. And then when I'm like, okay, there are some things that I have to make up to make this a narrative. Okay. When I'm thinking about that, like, what does it mean to make up something about this person who was killed because people made up things about her? Mm-hmm. Right. And so then there's like these layers of, what is my role in telling this story? What is my responsibility to her in telling this story? Both in the sense that I wouldn't have the story without her, and in the sense that I wouldn't be alive without her. And just sort of what, yeah, like, I have spent so much time thinking about her, and that connection is one way, as far as we know. Right. So, I think my relationship with her has been really powerful, in terms of being like an organizing and propelling presence in my own life. And it also has a lot of ambiguities built into it, and questions that will never be answered.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you brought up the fact that there's so much missing from the record. And, you know, I think a lot of people suspect that that was on purpose, that a lot of records were destroyed out of, you know, their own sense of shame and what they had done. But, you know, I also wonder, too, like, there's been, you know, 300 plus years between it. And, you know, who knows what early scholars did with this material? You know, who knows where anything happened? But it does look suspicious.
It definitely looks super suspicious. And yeah, I mean, like the Salem Village, like the Salem Court record book is gone. Like the stuff that described the trials themselves is gone. But I would be a little bit cautious of sort of taking that immediately to like there was a conspiracy of destroying the records. There was certainly a move towards silence in sort of the next century after the trials. The Puritans they were ashamed. They were like, we don't want to think about that. We know we screwed up. We don't really want to be reminded. But I think it's very likely that those things were just sort of allowed to fade into obscurity rather than being actively destroyed, actively burned or something. Yeah.
I think
we don't know.
Yeah, and we won't. I mean, there's at this point, it's kind of hard to figure out unless we find something in their attic, which I'm always amazed when things like that happen. But,
I mean, that's the dream, you know.
Exactly. One of the things I was thinking about, I was reading the book, and you kind of touched on this, is like, you know, their biggest fear was that these witches led by George Burroughs were trying to, you know, tear down the Puritan experiment in the New World, you know, because this was the devil's land they were taking and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, part of me wonders, like, you know, they didn't ultimately succeed. Although I would say it's easy to make an argument that Puritanism is alive and well.
We definitely could make
But I do wonder, is like, you know, is this part of the beginning of the end for them?
I think that it is part of the beginning of the end for them. I think that, the way that the effect that the trials have, first of all, the Salem witch trials take place a lot later than the height of the European witch trials. Mm-hmm. And while they should be understood as in the lineage of the European and specifically in the British witch hunts, they're happening, the height of the British witch hunts is like half a century to a century earlier. So the Puritans are already sort of, they're coming late to this. And within a century after this, Puritanism is going to be pretty, I'm going to say straight up discredited, but it is like, it's been a little bit discredited. One of the other things that the Puritans hoped to do with the Salem witch trials was encourage a religious revival, because sort of interest in Puritanism has been declining for a few decades leading up to the trials. And the ministers are always lamenting this, right? Like they're writing letters to each other and giving sermons about how people are, you know, it's like a youth these days sermon, but it is in Puritan style. And they're like, you know, there's too much sin, there's vice, we're not doing the thing that we were supposed to be doing. And there's some sort of hope that surfaces during the trials that like this moment of reclaiming all of these souls from the devil to God will sort of augur a greater religious revival of Puritanism. Mm-hmm. And instead it basically has the opposite effect, where within a few years, people are like, oh my God, like, I can't believe that you got so duped. And they're still thinking, I can't believe you got so duped by the devil. Mm-hmm. They're still working within the cosmological framework of Puritanism, but it is, it definitely starts to cause this sort of disillusionment with just how this could have happened.
Yeah. Well, and I think about, like, you know, there are characters that are close to the narrative, like Thomas Carrier, who wasn't a Puritan.
Right.
And, you know, so there were already people involved in the witch hunt that were not, that didn't buy into their ideology to start with. So I think it's just so fascinating to me, like the whole, like, especially, you know, I don't think 300 years on, we can really like completely understand their context, because we just mm-hmm. like the past is a foreign country, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But it's so interesting to think about like the people on this, you know, either caught up in it or on the sidelines who are like, what, this is madness from the beginning. Like, I think it's easy for us to go, oh, they were all in this, but there were people at the time who were like, no, this is madness. What are you doing?
So. Totally. And I think that that's a really important thing that often gets overlooked in the way that we talk about Salem. Just in referring to it as a hysteria, like mm-hmm. That's not quite an accurate thing to say. Mm-hmm. It was definitely about fear. Don't get me wrong. This is happening because they are afraid, but it is not something that is afflicting everybody equally, mm-hmm. and it is not inevitable. And this really shows up in a few spots. But like you said, that there are people who at the time are like, this, I think you're wrong. Like, this seems not correct. What are you doing? There is one guy who I think I touched on him only briefly in the book, but who was a Baptist minister who speaks out against it and is like, I think this seems incorrect. What's happening here? And he gets slapped with a sedition charge for criticizing the government. So I think that is like a really important example of A, there were people at the time who knew it was wrong and who spoke out against it. B, you got to be allowed to criticize the government without being afraid of a sedition charge. Mm-hmm. And C, the Puritan government at the time had a vested interest in protecting themselves. And it is maybe not a coincidence that the person who protested publicly and was then shut down was not a Puritan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sort of outside of the hegemony. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, and I would like that term of hysteria, like, I think I have to wonder if that seed wasn't partly planted, and you bring this up in the book about the a scholar who was talking about, oh, maybe it was ergot poisoning in the 70s. And I'm like, but I mean, like, they weren't all in Salem for one. Like, my my ancestry involved with this. Susanna Martin lived in Amesbury, and my ancestor, unfortunately, was a constable who brought her to Salem for her trial. But and then George Burroughs was in Maine, what is now Maine, but was part of the Massachusetts Bay Colony then. Like, they weren't all in Salem. They weren't all eating the same bread.
Certainly not. Yeah. I mean, we can definitely talk about the ergot theory as well, because let's touch on that briefly, because it's a very common one, and I totally get it. It is so nice to like be like, oh my God, they were tripping on acid. Like, it mm-hmm. was right. So the ergot theory is that there was a contaminated rye crop that was contaminated with a kind of fungus that contains chemicals that act similarly to LSD. Mm-hmm. The thing about this theory is, A, like you said, even if it's only afflicting the afflicted the accusers, right? Like sort of mm-hmm. the first girls who are the people who have these inexplicable fits where they're convulsing and they're going catatonic. And then they start accusing people of witchcraft. Even if it was just supposedly afflicted, you know, that they ate some contaminated bread, doesn't make sense for a couple reasons. Number one, the first two people to be accused, to be afflicted, who would be the two who would have to have eaten contaminated rye for this to work, live in a house together and are afflicted, like have these fits for more than a month before they start accusing anybody else of witchcraft. And nobody else in their household is showing any sign of anything, mm-hmm. Which is just like doesn't happen in an ergot outbreak. It used to be that people thought ergot, like this kind of poisoning, was physically contagious because it so rarely afflicted just one member of a household at a time because you're eating the same food.
Right.
It also always affects like all of the children in a household, and there were younger children than them in the house. Mm-hmm. Who never showed any signs of affliction. And then finally, it's like they're showing up with like the wrong symptoms, effectively the wrong kind of ergot. But we don't have to go into all that. Yeah.
Well, and I mean, even as early as the 1690s, like farmers knew what ergot was and what it looked like. I mean, they were very aware of it.
Right. So, and it's like it's true. This is a winter, you know, maybe they're forced into doing something because it's like they're running mm-hmm. out of food, but it doesn't fit. The symptoms yeah. don't fit. The way that it afflicts people doesn't fit. And the girls were doing other things like disobeying their elders and mm-hmm. having to throw the Bible in the fire and like doing these things that are not part of ergot poisoning. But because when you get ergot poisoning, it's like, it's not like you're just having a fun time tripping on acid and like maybe convulsing. It's like, it's bad.
Yeah. This yeah. is not refined LSD. This is like
it's not refined
poisoning. This is literally like, a poisoning. Like
yeah. Poison. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, I've always thought that was interesting. And I still hear people, you know, point to that. And I'm like, it's been debunked for a long time.
So. That is such an interesting thing, too. Right. Like yeah. it's been debunked basically since the year that it was suggested. And no shade to the person who suggested it. I totally get the, you know, I totally get the desire to. It's always important and interesting to look for like, you know, potential biological, materialist, chemical, reason, like, you know, explanations, but the fact that it has been debunked for like almost 50 years and it's still so ubiquitous does make me reflect on our sort of general, desire to have a very simple answer that also pretty much lets everybody off the hook.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, they were just tripping balls and, you know, poisoned by this thing that they didn't understand. So they did this. It's much worse, actually, to grapple with the truth, which is like, no, they were in their right minds.
Yeah.
They were existing in a certain culture that could be said to have.
Yeah.
You know, was acting like a poison. We could make that argument, but they were in their right minds when they hanged 19 people for witchcraft.
Yeah. Well, and I think about, you know, it would be convenient to have this one thing that lets people off the hook. Yeah. And I think it reflects on like our own desires to make things simple that are wrong now.
Yeah.
Because really, you know, there were multiple things that impacted why these behave. And some of those factors still exist. And I think that's also scary sometimes when you look at Salem through that lens. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that, and I say this pretty early on in my book, so not really a spoiler, but, you know, the sort of central question of Salem has been, how could this have happened? Mm-hmm. And the question that hides inside that question is, what's to stop this from happening again?
Nothing has stopped it from happening.
And the answer is it's happening.
Yeah.
So I understand why that is like not, we don't necessarily want that to be the answer.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that part of it. And I think I just love that you pull in so many threads that I think a lot of people try to look at Salem through. And it's kind of like, it's funny when you brought up the crucible, it's always made me think about, Paradise Lost in the Bible, like the crucible and what actually happened in Salem. It's like, you know, these are overlays. This is not the same thing. And, you know, Milton took some liberties, as did Miller.
Yeah. I mean, listen, The Crucible is a fantastic play. It's just not a historically accurate account of Salem. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. He was writing about McCarthyism. But it's like, that is usually, you know, if people learn about Salem in schools, it's probably through The Crucible. So it does create the misinformation.
Yeah. And I think it's good that you bring out too that, like, when Miller was writing the play, like, Salem was not this phenomenon that it is now. And so that really was the entry point for a lot of people to look at what happened in Salem, was through the fact that he had kind of brought that back into public consciousness through the play.
Totally. Yeah. He really, he has a big hand in bringing it back to life. Mm.
Although, you know, it's just interesting to me, like, the things that people take from The Crucible and then, like, no, this explains everything, that, you know, oh, it was an affair. Like, no, actually, he aged her up quite a bit.
let me do the two big ones. Jocelyn and Abigail Williams were not having an affair. She was 11. That would have been really bad. Also, she was not his maid, didn't live in his house. Mm-hmm. They didn't live on the same side of town. Like, no affair is happening. Number two is Tituba, who was not teaching anybody magic, like was not teaching anybody any kind of spiritual practice. Even that seems to have been an invention of a 19th century historian, Charles Upham, who writes sort of the first history of Salem, and reimagined Tituba as Black, when she was enslaved in the minister's household, but she was not of African descent, as far as the records tell us. She was Indigenous American of some kind, or possibly from Barbados.
Yeah.
She was also pretty young. I think that's a big thing, that, you know, in the Crucible and in the general imagination, she exists as like the crone. And she was probably like 30.
There's so many things. And like you said, there's so much we don't know. Like, we don't know what happened to Tituba after the trials. A lot of people dispersed, because why would you stay?
I mean, yeah. And Tituba is an especially horrible case, because she's in prison for over a year, and the Puritans charged, you had to pay to be in prison. You had to pay for your upkeep, for the food the jailer would give you. In order to be released, you had, even if you were found innocent or the charges were dropped, you had to pay for your jail fees before you could get out. So sometimes people would just languish there if they didn't have enough money to leave. And Tituba's, the man who legally owned Tituba, didn't want to pay her jail fees. And so he sold her. And she is basically, she gets sold out of the historical record. Mm-hmm. And we never hear about her again.
Yeah. And I mean, to think about being in prison for a year, like, your description of what the conditions were is just so horrific, of what Puritan prison looked like. And, you know, I know that you took some liberties in the story of kind of putting all of the main players in the same jail but none of the jails were great places to be. No, it didn't matter.
They were all pretty horrible. They were definitely all deeply unpleasant places to be held. Like, lightless, airless, stinking, hungry.
Flooding in some cases.
Flooding. Yeah. They were horrible.
Oh, yeah. That was, before we started recording, we talked and I listened to the audiobook. And those descriptions, it's like, it's just so visceral to think about, like, the suffering, and especially, you know, these women basically chained to the floor in this setting, and, you know, starving and sick and fevered and on top of each other. And, you know, just like, yes, hanging was awful, but for some of those people, it was probably release from what they had been through.
Yeah, it might be possible.
So I just want listeners to know that I did prep Alice for this question before. Because I'm not about, you know, being a gotcha kind of person, but I know from the book that you talk a little bit about, like, you have a Jewish background, and you know, so that was like there's some frisson in that looking at Puritan practice. Mm-hmm. And then also like in your narrative talking about unnamed folks who have their own maybe more supernatural or spiritual bent on things. And so, you know, having done all this research and looked at this and kind of living in a time when people purposely identify as a witch, you know, in a spiritual sense, like, what is that connection for you and how do you reconcile all of those things?
I mean, it's a good and a fair question. And yeah, I mean, so I tend to separate witchcraft from witch hunts. Mm-hmm. And my focus really is on witch hunts. And I make this separation because I think it's a pretty common and normal misconception that a lot of us have, where we expect that witch hunts and witchcraft have something to do with each other when they don't most of the time. And what I mean by that is that the majority of people who have ever been accused of witchcraft have not identified as witches. Mm-hmm. Or have not even like practiced something that we would sort of understand now in our modern conception as witchy, whatever we take that to mean. Like in Salem, for example, which is where I'll stick because mm-hmm. that is my focus. These people did some, a few of them did, you know, had like folk magic practices. But what I mean by that is like Ouija boards, you know, using almanacs to predict things, cracking an egg into a glass to see, you know, what's the profession going to be of the man who I'm going to marry, which you can think of sort of as like, you remember being like in elementary school and twisting the stem off an apple and the initial you land on is the first letter of your true love's name. It's kind of like that. So there are these folk magic practices that exist, but the people who are accused of witchcraft in Salem are mostly not doing them. Like mm-hmm. that's not why they're accused. These are Puritans. These are devout Christians. And they are everyone who dies in Salem, everyone who is executed by the state is someone who refused to confess to witchcraft. They are someone who refused to say, even on pain of death, that they were a witch. Mm-hmm. And that's really important to me. And so it's always... And, you know, Martha is one of these people.
Right.
So it's always felt important and sort of I feel responsible to her to make it clear that she was not a witch and she and the others who were killed alongside her died in part because they said that they were not. And they refused to even for an instant sort of believe the court when the court insisted that they were. As for myself, like you mentioned, I'm Jewish. I don't have a sort of spiritual witchcraft practice of my own. So I mostly sort of keep it on the, I'm really in the witch hunt side of things. Mm-hmm. And I think that when, you know, I've had some really interesting conversations with people who do identify as witches today. And I think that I just sort of look at it from, still from like this political point of view of, you know, most of, if you want to draw a connection between identifying as a witch now and the history of witch hunts, you really want to know like what kind of history you're drawing on and what that means.
One of the things you talk about in the book is visiting Salem, you know, now, and you visited the site of the new monument before it was built. And just like, you know, after doing the research, after writing the book or your thesis and visiting what is basically Witch Disneyland, like how do you reconcile that with the history that you steeped yourself in?
Yeah, I mean, listen, capitalism never saw a tragedy it didn't want to profit off. Right. Like, I think that it's not unique to Salem. I was mm-hmm. definitely I definitely didn't like it, what I was seeing when I went there the first time. And I was, I'm not talking about the museums. I'm really, and I'm not even, you know, I know that there are sort of witchcraft stores and communities there that really serve as like a spiritual center. And I'm not really even talking about that. I more mean like, listen, like I did walk into one witchcraft store and I saw that they were selling a Tituba sage smudge, that was supposed to, quote, bring like good luck to your home, business, or ritual space. And I was like, man, like, that's not what that's going to bring to your space, first of all. Like, that is not going to work. Because that's like, really calling on like Tituba for that? Like, there are certain things that I was like, this feels really disrespectful. And not everybody does that. And I want to make that really clear, yeah, that was a specific thing that I saw. But I do think that overall, you know, Salem as a town has a $100 million witch tourism industry and sort of Halloween tourism. It's the overall tourism industry. But my understanding is that they make a lot of that in the Halloween season. And it's real. It's the way of capital. And I personally will actually be up in that area next week for a talk. So I don't really know what else I can say.
I think, I mean, one of the things I think is weird. I've been to Salem a couple times, and the first time I've never been during October because I don't like
it's
crowds.
Crazy.
Yeah. I don't
it
do
was
crowds.
Black Friday. It was like really, yeah.
Yeah. I've been in the summer and then like later in the fall after the chaos of Halloween. But, walking down the street and a police car passing with like the witch logo on the door. Yeah. And I was just like, wow. Wow.
Yeah, no, I think that's,
especially with my history with Salem, I was just like, wow.
No, I think that's like on one level, I find it really funny. And on another, I'm like, this is kind of horrible. Because like for the, I get it, but for the sort of the state to adopt, like people forget that the Salem witch trials this was not a mob event. This was state execution.
Yeah.
This was the death penalty. Like they had trials. This was a legal process. It had the implicature of the governor. And so like for the state of Massachusetts to be like, we're going to sort of turn this into kitsch feels weird to me. Feels really strange. And I've seen this in a couple other places, where witch hunts have taken place in Europe, and where it's now, you know, a tourism attraction, and they'll sell like little dolls of like the witch, you know, little like witch models. And there's something about that, to just contrast the kitsch and the souvenir with the fact that like a woman was tortured and murdered here for being the thing that you are buying. And I don't want to like shame anybody. That's not really
it's complicated. Yeah. It's complicated.
It's more just like, I think that it is what happens to tragedy often. I think that it gets modified, and it gets repackaged. And especially with something like this, where now the image of the witch is basically divorced from the witch hunts in certain ways and has taken on a real role and power of its own. And people see it as a feminist icon and, you know, with validity, and people see it as it's its own powerful thing. And they're like, I want this to represent me. Mm-hmm. And it means something different than it did. So I think that, you know, an image can mean many things. A symbol can mean many things.
I think the conflation, I mean, that's the thing I've struggled with too, is the conflation between what the witch hunts really were and, you know, that we're the granddaughters of the witches you couldn't burn. I mean, most likely you're the grandchildren of the people who burned them.
Right. Statistically speaking. And also, I've always been kind of weird about that. I was like, well, what about the ones who did get burned? Like, what about that?
Yeah.
You know, the whole construction of that, I find.
And really, you know, like you said, these were, you know, largely like the people who were, especially in Salem, the people who were executed were people who would not confess. They were like the most Puritan of the Puritans.
Right. And they are people
like, they
who
wouldn't
are,
lie to save their own lives. And, you know, and I was like,
they died to not be called witches.
Right. So, yeah, it's, you know, and then, I mean, there's such a, you know, like in books and movies and all, you know, there's such this tie back to Salem, and you know that Salem had witches, and I was like, you know, the closest thing Salem had to witch was Richard Toothaker, and he wasn't even good at his job.
He was, I know, poor, yeah, this that guy. I'm like, yeah,
yeah,
and he's Martha's brother-in-law.
Yeah, and nobody claims him. Like when they talk about the witch, you know, it's like Bridget Bishop and Rebecca Nurse, and Rebecca Nurse, of course, no one even thought she was a witch then.
So. Yeah, no, totally. I mean, Roger Toothaker is like it's pretty sad. I mean, he's a folk doctor, and he is definitely just like having a hard time. Mm-hmm. Descriptions like he's always sort of leaving his family, wandering around. And then comes to believe that like he can kill witches, like clearly not having the best time.
Yeah.
But yeah, nobody wants to claim him.
Yeah.
Because I think, I mean, we want to believe believing in magic is like, and especially believing in magic, I think in a time and place like Salem, where you feel so powerless, to sort of really grapple with it and to be mm-hmm. like the breadth of humanity that is, yeah. you know, sort of horrible things that are happening. It's very seductive.
Yeah.
But it's not what was going on.
Yeah. So kind of a little bit of a 180 question, but when I was thinking about like reading the book, well, I have a physical copy in addition to buying the audiobook, because I was like, I just need an audiobook right now. So you published with Llewellyn, which I feel like this is a little out of their wheelhouse, actually.
Yes.
So I kind of wondered what the story was behind that.
I mean, they've been great. Mm-hmm. When they made the offer, I was like, you guys know that that's not quite what this book is. And they were like, yeah, we're interested in sort of expanding mm-hmm. and having this be part of our roster. And I was like, cool. And they've been great. But it definitely, I think actually it was really useful for me, because it also, you know, I wanted to sort of, take seriously, and I'm like, I'm really not trying to, you know, dismiss people who identify as witches mm-hmm. or witches. You know, I it's really just the focus on there being witches in Salem that I'm sort of adamant about.
Yeah,
and that I think, and Llewellyn was very good about that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, but it's definitely I'm not their usual fare for sure.
Yeah, because I was just you know, especially after having read the book, I was like, wow, this is really not usual Llewellyn fare. And I just wonder like what that's been like promoting the book, and like, do people have expectations about what they're getting because it is published with Llewellyn?
I don't know. I haven't, nobody's like said this to me mm-hmm. directly yet. I mean, I do get a lot of, you know, people who want to know about, I get interviewed by a lot of, like witch focused, outlets or podcasts and things, and which is great. Like I love to talk about it. And everyone who I've spoken to has been really lovely. But I do wonder sometimes if they like, they think it's going to be more about witches than about mm-hmm. witch hunts.
Yeah. Yeah. And that makes sense to me. That makes sense to me too. No, but I just think it's, I mean, and one of the things I really wanted to say about this for folks who haven't read the book, like, I know this is like your first book you've published, but it feels so accomplished. I mean, like, it's such a good book. And I was like, I can't believe this is your first book. Like, I'm just really looking forward to what comes next from you, because I just enjoyed it so much. But yeah, it's just, and I think, you know, for people who do currently identify as witches, like, I think it is important to know that, it's just important to know your own history, you know, as Americans or whatever. And I think it is important to understand that these, like you said, these are separate things.
They're just separate things. Like witchcraft as a religion, as a practice, is just separate from mm-hmm. witch hunts. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that, and there's, of course, there's interplay, there's overlap. Yes.
There are a lot of modern witches who base their practice on, you know, things from confessions of during the trials. And I mean, it is a complicated soup.
Yeah. So I would be wary of that, just because many confessions were elicited under torture. And we know that that doesn't work so well now. So I would just be wary about the validity. But yeah, totally. And I mean, I think another complex aspect of this is when we go into talking about witch hunts happening around the world today, some of those are directed toward people who have spiritual practices. Mm-hmm. Some of those are not. Still today, many of them are just directed at people who are poor, women who have access to, you know, to land or to certain kinds of resources that other people in their community mm-hmm. want, men that have access to land that other people in their community want, or just that they've had a land dispute with. It's, you know, it's all the petty grudges of a community. It's land, it's politics, yeah. gender, it's religion.
Yeah. I would recommend to read your book and also read Caliban and the Witch, because I think
usually, yeah. Sylvia's
it's a great
a giant.
Combo. It's a great combo to read together. But yeah, it's because I do think it's important to look and the scapegoat aspect to and you mentioned that there again for readers who have not had the opportunity to pick up this book yet, there's a list of people who were persecuted or killed as witches since Salem, and really a lot of those really were scapegoated people who are like, oh, our village is not doing well, let's find the source of this kind of stuff.
And I think find who's responsible,
right?
Which is a, you know, it's a very human impulse, and it gives you some control over the world. Just because it's understandable doesn't mean that it works.
Yeah, exactly. Well, like I said, I try to be respectful of everybody's time, but I could talk about this with you forever. But I did want to give you the opportunity, like I said, this will come out toward the end of January, and just kind of give you an opportunity to plug what's coming up for you. Like if you have more time, I know you've got talks coming up this fall, which this will come out after, but just what's coming up or where folks can find more about your work or follow you on social media, all that good stuff.
Totally. The only thing, I'm still sort of figuring things out for the spring, but I will be doing a talk at the Salem Witch Museum in March, pegged to International Women's Day. I'm not sure of the exact date yet, but it will be on my website, which is alicemarkhamcantor.com. And I'll post about it on my social media. You can find me at Alice Markham Cantor Author on Instagram. Alice M-DASH on Twitter.
Awesome. So, and we'll have links for all that in the show notes. So we have this little game of chance question at the end, which seems a tiny bit frivolous after our conversation, but we're going to go with it anyway.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. So I always joke on the show that I am a double Scorpio, and so I don't know how to do small talk very well.
Oh, yeah.
I want to know like the big, deep questions as soon as I meet somebody. So I'm going to roll a die, and depending on what I get, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money.
Okay, let's do it.
And if I get a six, you get to pick what you want. And you can also skip. So
okay.
So four, politics.
Okay. We haven't had enough of that yet.
I feel like, we've talked about this a lot already. This is a specific question. So I was thinking about, and this kind of lead on from what we talked about. So what do you think, if anything, do you contemporary witches who identify as witches owe to those people who were not witches of any kind but were accused and executed? Like what did modern witches owe them?
It's a great question. For me, I think it's thinking about, you know, these people who were accused for and killed for being witches and did not themselves say that they were witches. Were mostly accused and killed because they were vulnerable and divergent in some way. Poor, female, you know, transgressive something. And so I think that people who are, you know, taking on and stepping into that name, that legacy, I feel that there should be an attention paid to there should be solidarity with the most vulnerable and the sort of divergent in society today. Like if you're going to take on the sort of witch role, the witch identity, that's great. And I think that I feel that it owes some solidarity to those people who are the ones who like would have been the witches of the past.
Yeah, I agree. Totally. Like, I think it is so important to, like, the word witch has always been political, and now it's political in a different way, but that doesn't erase the history of the word either. So
right. I think this is what, you know, the feminist movement in the 60s to sort of reclaim witch, this is what it was trying to pull on, mm-hmm. where it was saying, you know, this is a source of power, and we are specifically paying attention to the ways in which, you know, in this case, it was women have been ostracized, excised from society, othered. And so I think, like, to be a witch today means paying attention to who is getting othered in today's society, mm-hmm. who is vulnerable, who is, you know, who would be the first to be accused, and really having solidarity with those people and showing up for them.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, one of the conversations I see happen and has, you know, kind of cropped up again with a lot of the political stuff around QAnon and things like that is kind of this resurgence of the satanic panic in this new packaging, which, and then also all goes back to anti-Semitism too. Like, it's all tied together in a package.
All tied together. I mean, a lot of the, like, imagery of the witch that we have, the regular witch imagery, is, like, tied to anti-Semitic, tied to anti-Semitism of the European ages.
Yeah. So I think it's, you know, again, I just think it's important for us to know our history. And, like, if, to me, you know, identifying as a witch today, especially, like, knowing now my ancestry and the connection to Salem, and I am sure if I could dig deep enough and the records existed, I am also tied to other European witch hunts, because that's just how ancestry works. There's only so, we only have so many forebears for the millions of people who live now. But, you know, and I think what you said at the top about, you know, you exist because Martha Carrier existed, you know, like, that she saved her children by making them lie, you know, like, it's just, it's all connected. And to just kind of sever those threads or pretend that, you know, they were witches, or, you know, just to disrespect their memory in that way seems just so completely antithetical to what I think a witch today means.
Right. I think it's like, I think people want to use it as a source of inspiration, mm-hmm. and of power to be, you know, to have a real sort of expression of self and a real, like, attention to the world around them. And I think that this can be a part of that.
Yeah. Oh, Alice, thank you so much. This has been such a great conversation. And like I said, I'm sure we could talk for hours, but, you know, again, people have finite time in their life.
Thank you.
And good luck on whatever comes next for you. Like, I'm excited to see what that is.
Thank you. Yeah. I'll let you know. I'll keep you updated.
Yeah. Sounds good. Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay. And our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram or Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. And thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.